Good afternoon. This is the special board meeting for Austin Firefighters Relief and Retirement Fund Board. It's Wednesday, October 19th. First up, do we have any speakers signed up? Jim Boynton?
Yes, we have a Jim Boynton.
That's fine.
I'm Jim Boynton. I'm here to apologize to the rest of the fund members forever. Nominating Jeremy Burke. I was the guy that nominated him originally. Jeremy's been an unmitigated disaster for our pension, a complete disaster. I feel bad for Anu and the staff. They're trying to straighten things out. The more they work, the more problems they're finding. We do not need this dissension in our pension. We need to get together and be sure that we're getting COLAs, and we don't need interference from somebody who has no regard for the people he's supposed to be representing. Apparently, he has his own agenda. He still wants to try to force out Anu, in my opinion, to put his buddy back in. We do not need that. I sent out a letter, and I want to make a clarification because Bob Nix mentioned to me yesterday, that they had offered people, Brad Landy, Jeremy, and Keith Johnson, access to money for a lawyer. Jeremy took it. Brad Landy left because he was guilty. Keith Johnson was the whistleblower. He had no culpable part of that. We need to demand Jeremy's resignation. He doesn't need to be talking to the membership, the staff, city employees, the mayor, or anybody else in an aggressive and nasty manner as he conducts himself. The feedback I've gotten from that letter is pretty astronomical. People in the fire service, in the stations, don't want to speak up because of fear of retribution, because they're given an opinion. I can understand that. But we as retirees need to stand up for the right thing. I want you to know I appreciate everybody trying to do the best job they can. Absolutely, Jeremy is not trying to do the best job, and he's still being extremely aggressive and dismissive of the staff. His involvement in so many different things that look unethical probably are unethical. There's no telling how much money trying to shove Primal down our throat will cost our pension in the long run, but I assure it's going to be in the millions. I really believe that from the bottom of my heart. I'm calling for also an audit over the last couple of years because I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other speakers?
Yes.
Jan Weston. Okay. Jan Weston, come on up.
Okay, thanks. I wasn't really prepared to speak today because I thought I was just going to come listen to a meeting, but
Jan,
after hearing Mr. Boynton say such disparaging things about my friend Jeremy, and it upsets me. Jeremy, I nominated Jeremy this year for our trustee because I've been watching the pension board for the last 7 years after some things happened in 2015 that were unfavorable. And so I've either been on Zoom or at the meetings when we were having them and watching how prepared Jeremy is for each meeting. I know you're a smart man. You're learning about it. But as far as our trustees, the person that really knows, you know, what's going on and the questions that need to be asked from, you know, the different vendors that show up, Jeremy's the guy. And we would be at a real loss if we lose him. So first, I had to say that just because of what just got said, which is very disturbing. I am with the Retired Firefighters Association. I'm a vice president, one of two. Our other one is here. And I've also talked to many of the retired firefighters as well as active firefighters, and I try to find common ground. And what I'm hearing from the firefighters that, you know, aren't in this whatever spewing awful stuff, but just they want the betterment of the fund. They want us to work together as firefighters, which is what, you know, that's what we did when we worked. You know, if you didn't work together, you didn't, you may not survive. So, you know, we're a group that's used to working as a team. And so what I'm hearing from a lot of the folks, both retired and actives, is they would like to see us work together. And when there's a personal difference, that remains out of sight of the camera. You know, those things need to be handled with those two individuals, not aired as dirty laundry. You know, this is only going to tear us apart if we keep having things like what just happened happen. You know, as the saying goes, together we stand, divided we fall. So my hope is that we'll figure out a way to support each other, and also that the trustees that are on this board, what I'm hoping is that there's a unanimous feeling that the firefighter pension remain firefighter pension, that it doesn't get absorbed into a city pension or a Austin Police Department. I'm not saying that that's going to happen. I'm just saying that's a fear. I have to present that because that's some of the things I'm hearing from the retirees and also the actives. So, so I just hope. Is that my buzzer? I thought I was buzzed out of here looking for the trap door. Anyway, sorry, that wasn't very prepared. But, you know, again, Jeremy is a wonderful man, and he has so much integrity. And I just hope that we start treating each other with respect again. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Any other speakers? No other speakers.
No other speakers.
Very good. So let's move on. Discussion and possible action. It looks to me like item 1 and 2 are intertwined. So if there's no objection, I think we should take them both up at the same time. Jeremy.
I had actually requested item 2 to be on the October 28th meeting, and had gotten a confirmation email that it was going to be back, that it was going to be on that agenda. I'm not sure how it made it on this one. So
you want to move it to the 28th?
That's
table it to the 28th?
That's what the email I got from Manu was, that we were going to do it on the 28th. So I'm not sure why it was here. Maybe she has some insight. I'm just not. It caught me off guard.
Sure. So that was based on the email you had sent me requesting this agenda item be on the October board meeting. And since there were two meetings happening in the month of October, the first email I sent you was acknowledging the request as well as mentioning that we can put it to the October 28th meeting since you had requested two items. Looking back, I realized that was intertwined with the discussion that was going to happen at this meeting, and I followed up with an email to you before we posted the agenda mentioning that we will add it to the special board meeting.
Okay.
So, do you wish to move it to the 28th?
My original goal of having it moved to the 28th was so that we could have our actuary be able to talk on that subject. I don't know if our actuary was here today or wasn't invited to be on the phone call.
I don't see any issue with keeping it on today's agenda if it does tie into number one, but then also maybe adding it to the 28th agenda if we want to have the actuary speak to the items.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. If everybody's good, then we'll proceed. Anu?
Good afternoon, trustees. Anumeha Kumar, I'm the executive director. With regards to agenda item 1, I requested this agenda item, and I was hoping to provide some background information to the trustees. Just as a quick refresher, as I had made you all aware at the September 26th board meeting, the fund issued an RFP for actuarial services on September 23rd, and the actuarial firms had until October 14th to respond to our RFP. Just recently, I was attending the Pension Review Board meeting on October 6th at the State Capitol Building, and I had an unfortunate conversation with Brad Heinrichs from Foster & Foster, that's our current actuary, outside the PRB meeting room, which was witnessed by many pension community members. Brad informed me that Trustee Burke had called him after our September 26th board meeting to tell him that I had informed this board in a public meeting that Foster & Foster provided bad or incorrect data to City of Austin. Brad was visibly upset about this fact, and we had significant differences regarding what was shared at the September 26th board meeting. Trustee Burke's discussion with Brad happened during the RFP blackout period, essentially, and it violated one of the mandatory requirements of the RFP. Upon Trustee Burke's request, I had provided a copy of that draft RFP to the board at its August meeting. So, I, of course, I would have hoped that Trustee Burke and the rest of the trustees had the opportunity to familiarize themselves to those RFP requirements a month in advance. Trustee Burke's communication with Foster & Foster not only disrupted the RFP process, but it also created misunderstanding and tension between fund staff and one of its key vendors, which was counterproductive to the overall fund operations. Now, let me review very quickly the RFP requirement that I mentioned just now. We have provided a meeting packet to your trustees, and in your packet, the first document is that RFP, which was issued in September. If you look at page 8 of that RFP, there is a requirement under mandatory requirements section that states unauthorized communication. No proposer may discuss this RFP or actuarial services with any current or prospective members of the AFRRF Board of Trustees or with any city official or employee. Communication is restricted to Anumeha Kumar, AFRRF Executive Director, other than the interviews by the board of finalist candidates. Now, by making that phone call, Trustee Burke caused Foster & Foster to violate that mandatory requirement of the RFP. Foster & Foster had initially stated, and I have included that email in your packet as well, had initially stated they will respond to our RFP, but eventually they could not. Trustee Burke mischaracterized the discussion about the special auditor's report to Foster & Foster. He could have easily reached out to me first if he had concerns regarding my statements at the board meeting instead of contacting our incumbent actuary directly without informing the fund. Now, going back to the discussion on this topic at the September board meeting, September 26th board meeting, upon Trustee Burke's request from this past Saturday, I have provided a copy of the email exchanges between the city, the fund, and Foster & Foster. That takes us to our second agenda item, as requested by Trustee Burke. I would like to go over some of those emails with you, but again, before I say anything, and as I had stated at that board meeting, I have to reiterate, it is my belief that those issues happened predominantly due to lack of resources. The emails that's included in your meeting packet clearly shows that the fund staff and the consultant were trying to provide the information that the city was requesting, but there was miscommunication and a lot of delay. The city initially made their data request back in July of 2021, and the final wrap-up of the request happened early March of 2022. The request from the city there is a timeline included in the packet, in those emails that I have provided to you. The very first email that's included is the most current email that Foster & Foster responded to city's request for census data for the current year. And in that response, Foster and Foster said, the census that was used as the underlying data in the 12/31/2020 actuarial valuation report is enclosed. As you know, the data discrepancies were corrected this year for 29 retirees and beneficiaries and will not be reflected in our 12/31/2020 data. So I was factually correct to state that there were data discrepancies, i.e. wrong date of birth, that caused further delay, that caused the city and their auditor to conduct further testing. And at the September 26th board meeting, I had also clarified that those issues were not material. I had stated that there was no concern regarding the overall data that was provided. The concern came in where the data that Foster and Foster had provided did not match the data that the fund had provided. The city came back, made all parties aware that there is a discrepancy in the data. The fund has been providing the census data to the city. So the city assumed that the data the fund has been providing is correct and Foster and Foster's data is not, and asked the fund to make sure that the information is reconciled. And you will see in those 92-page document that I have produced with all the email exchanges that the fund staff at the time, this was in March and April, engaged in a thorough process of going back, checking every single member's driver's license, date of birth, to make sure and identify if it was the fund's data that was wrong or the actuary's data. The goal was to get the data corrected. I did not come to the board and raised any red flags that the data that the actuary has provided to the city was wrong. That discussion came up in a larger context when we were talking about the city's special auditor's request, and I provided or responded to some of the questions that Trustee Burke was asking about what was it that the city is requesting or what happened at the time. And the intention, as was mischaracterized, was not to publicly say that Foster and Foster provided bad data. So I just want to make sure that I clarify that for everyone. And you can see that information is contained in the emails that I have provided to you. Trustees, you all have tasked me as the fund's executive director to manage the day-to-day operations of the fund, including the fund's relationships with its vendors, which is a key responsibility. And I have been doing my best to accomplish that. However, this type of communications disrupts the relationship between staff and vendors, and I don't feel I have strong relationships with the fund's vendors because of these types of behavior. Today, we proudly say that we are a much larger fund and are more mature compared to before, and that's exactly right. We are. We are no longer a small fund, and we are certainly not a Telfra fund anymore, so we should stop acting like a small fund or stop acting like a Telfra fund. We are over $1 billion now and trying to continue to grow, and sound governance practices are key to accomplishing that goal. In a bigger pension fund, sound governance, among other things, means clearly defining the roles and responsibilities of staff and the board, and where trustees from a day-to-day operations standpoint are mostly responsible for overseeing the executive director. I understand this wasn't the case before for our fund, but in a big organization such as ours, if roles and responsibilities aren't clearly delineated, it is a recipe for disaster. Case in point, the issue we are dealing with today. Let me make it clear, it doesn't matter who the trustee was. It's not about an individual. I'm worried about the structure overall here. And because of those reasons, I'm requesting stricter provisions in our governance policy to clearly define those roles and responsibilities so we can thwart these unwarranted issues to arise in the future and to ensure that staff stays focused on performing the critical projects that we are currently working on and not get distracted by these issues. I'm specifically requesting the board to consider that moving forward, any form of trustee communication with any of our vendors, including investment managers, can only happen through fund staff. Or consider any other appropriate mechanisms. If Chuck can share how other funds handle this issue, I'm open to that. I'm also requesting to strengthen our ethics policy by adding stricter provisions surrounding blackout periods when the fund issues an RFP for any service provider.
I mean, I'm happy to speak, I know if you'd like me to, just on the what other funds have done in this situation. Certainly, there's less for, as she mentioned, for smaller funds when the board has more involvement in day-to-day operations. There's not as much delineation, but as funds mature, there's provisions that are put into place where any communication that a trustee does have with a vendor is done in conjunction with and in connection with the executive director or staff, and that person's kept in the loop with respect to those communications to avoid kind of the mixing of roles where individual trustees are going and interacting directly with vendors and consultants, and so the relationships between staff and vendors come into play. I just gave a speech at a recent meeting talking about that concern in terms of, look, if you're a trustee and you're talking to a vendor, there's a piece of potential undue influence there, right? You've got a position of authority. You're a trustee of a fund, and they're likely to listen to you and talk to you potentially over even staff, right? That just can't happen or shouldn't happen in a fund, and it needs to be clear that everything goes through the executive director and two staff. And not to say that there's certain questions, there may be times where you're referred to speak directly to them, but it's important for the staff to be aware of them and know that those are going on. What you'll see in policies or strict provisions kind of saying that, hey, if there's going to be communication between staff and a vendor, that the staff executive director is kept in the loop or provided information and coordinate those. And they come in a lot of different slices in terms of how that exactly words and how you want to phrase that, but that's the general thrust of those.
So let me ask you a question. Would you say that our policies are a little wishy-washy on that subject? Because I had the understanding that I should not be contacting vendors unless I go through the executive director.
The specific policy I think that's kind of the potential issue, is that if any requests for work right now do have to go through the executive director. If you're going to ask me or any other vendor to do some type of services that's going to incur funds, you have to either come to the board with the request or go through executive director with the request. But there's not any strict prohibitions on just communications outside of a board meeting. There's not.
Okay. Board members? John?
No, I support strengthening our governance because these moments, like why we're here today, are self-inflicted wounds. They're unnecessary, and they seem to paralyze our progress, unfortunately. And then there's ripple effects from this that linger. And so I think whatever we need to do to ensure that this type of thing, intentional or otherwise, doesn't happen in the future so that when we go through an RFP process or anything else, that it's not, there's no destructive part of that process that then affects the outcome later, which has happened in this case.
Okay. Linda?
I'm supportive of strengthening our governance policy as well. I do think that there does need to be a clear delineation. Our staff, we hire the executive director. We are the ones who we take part in choosing these key vendors. But the operations of the fund, the day-to-day, is done so by staff, and we shouldn't be in any part interfering with that. So that's my my view on this topic.
Okay. Jeremy?
I like the idea of strengthening the governance policy. I think if you get it clear on what the roles and responsibilities are, I've always been a huge advocate of that so that you know what's required of you. I think that would be good. I see Chuck's point about how this comes together as a trustee, you're not allowed to request additional work, and I've always made sure that's something that I have not done in the past. And when talking to a vendor or someone in the past, made sure that there wasn't going to be a cost to the fund. Most times when I have talked to a vendor, it's in an educational format, trying to understand, hey, can you explain this versus that? And so I'm supportive of the changes that ANU's asking for.
Okay. Well, that makes it unanimous because I feel the same way. I feel like a lot of the communications, like if it's an educational type question, if it goes through ANU, then ANU has the ability to distribute it to everybody rather than just one trustee getting information directly. So I'd like to see that consistency. Chuck, what kind of action do you need us to take?
It's really direction. I mean, the ultimate action is going to be bringing forth a policy language for you all to look at and review and approve. I will say, in addition to that, just so there's not, I do think the blackout period or the no contact period in connection with communication with vendors is important as well. And delineating that. There is in your code of ethics, you're not allowed to accept any gifts, whether permissible or not, from a vendor right now during a no-contact period. And obviously in RFPs, there's some strict language with respect to not having vendors talk to consultants as well. But that needs to be also just part of it as well from that blackout period perspective.
Linda.
Regarding the RFP blackout period, is that specified in the ethics policy, or do you think it's more appropriate to be detailed within the governance?
There's a piece in the ethics policy now that deals with the gifts and benefits pieces of it. So, no, that is a little more of an ethics policy piece. So I think it's more appropriate there as opposed to – I mean, because, look, I mean – If communication is properly done with a vendor, right, and it's communicated and the staff's in loop and agrees with yes, I think it's important for whatever trustee to have this conversation. Thank you for letting me know. I'd like to be a part of it, or no, I don't think it's appropriate. It's not the idea that staff communication with vendors is, you know, there just always needs to be that connection and process there. So that's why there's a difference between governance and ethics, where it is. Potentially, there's ethics issues if you start to talk with vendors or deal with vendors during a no-contact period, and that's where that comes into play.
Jeremy.
So I would like to elaborate on what you said with the RFP blackout period. One of the things that I liked when we went through the RFQ pass process, we had a timeline, and it had specific dates of when things were going to happen, and that was really useful to me, because when we started off with that, I was able to say, hey, here's when the stuff's going to occur, and I knew that there were vendors that were interested in responding, and I could let them know, hey, go ahead and reach out to ANU so you can make those responses, and then I knew I wasn't outside of any dates or timelines. And with this current process, I wasn't sure, did we have a timeline on this RFQ? Because I couldn't find anything with the
date. I had informed the board on September 26th that the RFP was already issued on the 23rd. So everyone knew the RFP had been issued, and everyone was put on notice that the response due date is October 14th.
Okay. And looking at that, I went back and I re-listened to the meeting to make sure I had it in there, because I had it in my notes down that the RFP process was going to start in October. And I wondered how I got to that, how I found out October. And when I went back and listened to the information that was in there, the conversation started off that we were looking at hopefully issuing an RFP by October. And I missed during the meeting that you said it had been put up the last week before in the conversation. I will openly admit that I missed that you said that. I was taking notes, and within that, it said, hopefully we'll have it by the October meeting. We're sending it to TechSpurs, and that's what I had written down in my notes. So
that was the response, and I will bring the vendors. We had a detailed conversation about it, given you wanted to make sure I don't come to the board with a recommendation like it happened with the PAS vendor. You were trying to make sure that doesn't happen with the actuarial services process. So we had a lengthy discussion about it.
Yes.
And I had mentioned to the board that my goal would be that I bring the firms for board to interview at the October meeting. That was the discussion.
I can play you what I heard if you would like.
Sure.
Melinda?
I don't think it's necessary to replay a prior board meeting.
Well, the reason I'm replaying it is because she's calling into question what I heard and what my understanding was. And there was clearly she had said something, and I took it to mean October, and I'm acknowledging that there was a misunderstanding. When this agenda came out, I went back. I went and listened to the meeting as it occurred, and I missed that it had been issued last week. That's why a minute ago I was offering to sit there and say I liked the RFQ process that we did with the timeline where it had written down dates and communications, because outside of that meeting and a verbal comment, I don't have any other thing in regards to dates with the RFQ. That was a useful tool that when I was looking at trying to move forward with this that I felt was really good for the trustees, because I have tried to adhere to the blackout periods, tried to be above board on these things, and not make these mistakes.
The RFP was posted on the website as well. But
okay, I think we all agree that it was a miscommunication.
I think it would be good, too, is when we do post these RFPs, something that would be helpful is just I saw you sent this email to Brad letting him know that it was open and available. I think just a simple email that, hey, I'm sending out the correspondence to the trustees would also be helpful, because then it'd be like, hey, this is issued, it's live, here's the final. And then I went back and looked at the draft that was proposed, as you said, and it had that comment in there. There was not a date in the draft.
There was no date, but the draft had those requirements in there.
Correct. And knowing those requirements, I would adhere to those requirements and not speak to somebody. I just didn't have the dates and a timeline. And I think in the future, if we had the date and the timeline or an email saying, hey, this is now live, just a reminder, trustees, please don't do these things, I think it would be helpful for all of us moving forward.
Chuck, I got a kind of an additional item that's related to this. In regards to communication with vendors. In your work with other boards, are they strict on, I'm going to a conference next week, so I've already been invited to 3 different dinners by vendors, and of course the expectation is that the vendor's going to pay for the dinner. And I know that's more than $5 based on where they're going, and I think it's inappropriate. Are other boards allow or disallow those type of things?
Certainly, depending on what level of government you are, particularly, for example, statewide funds, the TRSs, the ERSs of the world have specific laws applicable to them that have very strict limits on what can be provided from a dollar amount. And I think I don't want to speak out of turn. Some funds do apply those moving through in terms of that and reporting that also in terms of when those happen. So everyone knows there's not influence. With those dinners as well, i.e. if you go out to dinner with somebody, you've got to report it to the system as well. Okay. So there's kind of a internal check and control. Everybody knows that somebody's not well, what's going on in that regard. And that's similar, frankly, that's done in the consultant world as well in terms of when managers are trying. That's just what I know of that world as well, to keep checks on it. So, and obviously with local funds, there's less regulation in that regard. But the larger the fund gets, the more regulation in that regard there is. So, yeah.
Okay. Would the board entertain a strengthening on that issue too? That if you do attend one of those, you report it to the fund administrator. The executive director.
I support that.
I do as well.
Sounds good.
Okay. Do you have enough information going forward for changing?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments on these 2 items?
I do, and this is directed towards Trustee Burke. Outside of the RFP issue, what were you hoping to accomplish by contacting the actuary after the meeting?
Only thing I was hoping to accomplish was to let him know some disparaging marks that were said about him and his work. I wanted him to be aware of what was said at our board meeting about him and his company. And I just told him where the video was, and it would be worth his time to go at this particular minute and hour to see what was said.
And so my next follow-up question is, how do you feel that benefited the fund or its members?
I think it's important for the fund and its members to know what our executive director is saying about vendors that we have and relationships that we've had with them in an open forum and an open meeting. I feel like some of those comments could have been, in my opinion, reserved or maybe discussed offline. I didn't see them being constructive to what we were trying to do in the agenda of let's work on this item of getting it more efficient for the census data.
I just want to point out that that timeline of discussion was created by questioning, and Anu was attempting to answer the questions as best as possible in an environment that typically gets aggressive and heated, and that becomes difficult. There's also absolutely nothing wrong or infactual about saying if a vendor's made a mistake, that they've made a mistake. And if a vendor does make a mistake, it's appropriate to bring it up in a meeting. There's nothing wrong with that. That can be handled professionally down the line. And so I don't find any issue with that action whatsoever. I mean, we should welcome that. And so I just want to point that out. I have some broader comments.
And you touched on exactly that.
Okay. Go ahead. Finish.
So I'm going to back up. Before I got on the board, I want to show you all my perspective. I saw a board that had, in my view, personal battles. There was seemingly a lot of false narratives around how various divisions and factions, if you will, were told to think about the other side. It's all noise, and it's all a distraction from what we're really supposed to be doing. And frankly, it's embarrassing for the fund as a whole, for the operation, for everybody involved in it. It's very destructive. And when I was asked to join, I was very reluctant for all these reasons. And in fact, I initially politely declined. I was asked again, and you know, I decided I couldn't say no twice, and I knew potentially what I was getting into. I knew it was going to be very difficult. Unfortunately, there are politics in anything we do, and when it involves money, there are especially politics, unfortunately. So fast forward into my first year and now my second, I would characterize where we're at now as a bit of a hangover period, where these divisions and these things, for whatever reason, linger. And they linger is extremely unfortunate because of all of the good things that I see we're trying to accomplish here. And we have done good things through Anu's leadership. These things are slowly happening, but that's the key word, slowly. It's this sort of paralyzing and obstructing behavior that stops the advance of many things we could do. We're here for an additional meeting that might not have been needed. I think every one of us can attest to extra phone calls, extra time answering questions, just extra emotional energy, if nothing else. It's a taxing thing. And the issue is not, it's not that we disagree. We're going to have disagreements when you have groups of people. It's how you disagree. I've said this before. If we view each other cynically, or we view each other as adversaries, then we are going to have adversarial interactions. That's what happens. We cannot do that. It's that's a function of ego and personal emotion and all the things that cloud your judgment. And when you operate in clouded judgment like that, you tend to make bad choices and bad decisions, especially if done impulsively, etc. To Anu's comments, we have to be more professional than that. We are responsible for a massive pile of money and for the livelihoods of everybody we're responsible for. Doing these things, the behavior that's extended into the first, in my experience, the first 2 years, and we've seen this in several meetings, I appreciate the tone is different this meeting, hasn't been in the past, but it serves no one. Serves no one. And I think for me, because these issues are ongoing, and despite previous efforts, including communication, Chuck and Elisa, education about communication that Chuck and Elisa gave us several meetings ago, which was appreciated. And because this now has reached a point where it's actually disrupting fund operations, I would like to move that the board request that Trustee Burke resign for the good of everybody. And on a personal level, Jeremy, this does not speak to the commitment and the good work you've done in the past. We all acknowledge that. But I think we're at a moment where we simply need to coalesce and move on, and move on without division, without the staff having to deal with unnecessary challenge, and so that we can all get on down the road and do the best work that we can. And that's my piece.
Okay. Have a motion. Do we have a second?
Go ahead. I will second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second.
I'd like to just, from an agenda perspective, I'm not sure moving on this item at this point in time is appropriate from an agenda perspective. That's just the sentiments expressed, but I don't think a formal motion from a resignation motion is I don't think we're agendaed for that. If there's concerns that might be addressed that can be done through the ethics policy, that's potentially okay. But that's my concern, and I apologize to – I didn't know it was coming, but I don't think it's agenda appropriate.
Okay. Understood.
Understood, and thank you for the comment.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on these two items? Jeremy.
The only thing I would like to add is I think it's important that when we are talking about our vendors, that we need to be careful with the things that we're going to say in regards to them in a negative manner. And I don't think that's what occurred at the September meeting. So back to your question as to why. That's why I was let Foster and Foster know that there were some comments made and that he should reach out to Anew so that these differences could be figured out. Because when our executive director is saying that our actuary, who we had for 9 years, is providing inaccurate data, incorrect information, and is not providing it on time, that's troubling to me. Does that mean what the new is experiencing is the case? Or is the vendor really failing us? Or is there something in between? And that's why when we had the issue with Wolf Poplar, I mentioned I wanted to get him in here because I find the best way to work through these differences is for the two people to sit down in the same room so we all can hear what they are. Y'all did not support me on that motion, which is fine. And that's why I added this agenda item to try to get the vendor and both the executive director in here to sit down and let's figure out what these inaccuracies are. And on agenda item 2, I went back, looked at some of my notes from the census data and special auditor's report. It took a lot longer, one, because it started in November when you look at the emails. Like, I want to say the 19th, right before.
No, it started in July. The request was made in July.
Okay.
And it started in August. Like, the actual work started in August.
All right. So, in the emails, the furthest date I had back was...
It took me a very long time to put this together, but I'm confident that the actual work started in August.
Okay. The furthest date I recalled was somewhere around November that there were some issues when I looked at it.
It was in November that some action started taking place. You're right.
Right.
But the request was made in July. There were discussions in August. And then I believe there was a planning meeting set up in November sometime after a lot of back and forth. And then December, I don't think any action was taken in December until January. I think there was some movement again in January until I believe the city realized there were data discrepancies. So additional testing had to be done. There were additional questions and information that was requested. That happened in February. Again, follow-ups, and they were close to the deadline to release the city's financial report is when everything got resolved, I believe, a week or two before the actual publication of the report.
Okay. And I went back, looked at the notes, and it looked like part of the reason the information wasn't provided on time, looking at some of the notes, was there's issue gathering from the fund staff, one, getting, they were trying to get it from the city of Austin and AFD, and they had told, AFD had recommended that the fund do an open records request if they wanted that particular information to reconcile those birth dates. Kendall was working on this project. She may or may not remember that. And I remember I had taken the notes here in the board meeting where the mayor said, hey, if that's the case, CC me on those emails. This was also the same time period before you were starting. And a lot of the direction that the board had given fund staff was to hold off on projects knowing that you were coming in.
So it's my understanding. Kendall can chime in. I think she is here. I wasn't here at the time when the date of birth issues occurred, right? But the city was able to identify the issue went back to the source of the data. The city was used to receiving the census data file from the fund. In the last go-around, they ended up receiving it from Foster and Foster, is when they identified the date of birth. On my end, it was in March and April that we worked hard to identify all the date of birth, and we asked, you will see in the email exchanges, we asked the city if they could provide the list of the members that had the wrong date of birth, which the city did. They provided the list. We, John and Kendall, worked hard in identifying and making sure we flagged the correct date of birth, which we did. And that's when we realized that majority of the date of birth among those 29 or 30 members was Foster and Foster's data. And we asked Foster and Foster to make sure they go back and correct the data. Now, Jeremy, going back to your point, be it Wolf Popper, be it Foster and Foster, I have to say this. Had I meant to reflect negatively on Foster and Foster, the time to do that was back in April when we identified the mistakes, when we informed them of the mistakes. That was the time to come to you all and say, look, I found all these errors. I did not do that. The discussion we had in September was not about Foster and Foster being wrong. It was about the issues and the challenges. And you asked specific questions, and I responded to those questions. Going back to Wolf Popper, they reached out to my predecessor first back in December of 2021. Since then, they have been reaching out for the data that they were requesting. I kept asking them, give me time. I'm busy. I have a lot right now going on right now. I need more time to understand and work on everything else that was going on. Is this? And so we kept working on it. Of course, they were copying you on their correspondence, and then I received emails from you. What's the holdup? Why are you not taking any action on this? That's when I feel there's a deep distrust in the work that we do, right? And when I presented the information to the board, again, I presented it from a factual standpoint. I was not mincing my words. I stated the facts as they stand. I stated that here's our policy. And if this is our policy, I don't believe there's any reason to provide direct access to them, is what my recommendation was. What that resulted in was at the Telfra conference, Wolf Popper was there. We had significant differences and exchanges because, of course, they reach out to you directly. And that's the governance issue, the crux of the issue that we are talking about today, right? You may feel talking to the vendors gives you a separate insight into the fund operations, but I question, why is it that you did not come to me first and ask, why did you say all these things about Foster and Foster instead of reaching out to Foster and Foster, which implicitly you have more trust in Foster and Foster, and you question everything that we do, apparently. And I don't know how to resolve that.
I don't think it's a matter of questioning everything you do. It's just trust and verifying the things that are being said. And I just want to make sure that I'm getting both sides of what's going on. And that is my goal at the end.
So I don't know if that's the role of a trustee, to be a referee.
Well, certainly the role of a trustee with respect to determining whether or not facts are said or go on don't need to be brought up in a board meeting. And that's not, I mean, if you have questions about what's going on, the trustees must appropriately to happen those outside of a board meeting and had discussions with them. To have continual conversations regarding how things occurred and data and factual inaccuracies with your executive director would have turned into one-on-one conversations, going to John's point, gets away from the business of the board in this setting. And frankly, whether it's the timeline of an RFP that's been under consideration since April or a factual issue with a data request that is just trying to get resolved moving forward, those are issues that are don't need to be resolved on a board level in terms of what a prudent board should be doing. Those issues should be, if there are questions about there need to be outside of that, y'all should be worrying about the missions of the fund, frankly, and the overall health of the fund and providing benefits to members, as opposed to whether or not birth dates are wrong on census data. And that's my view of a trustee's role in this matter.
Okay. I could use some clarification on something then.
Certainly.
On the governance policy, section 2.2, where it talks about board responsibilities, one of the bulleted points says hiring and monitoring certain third-party service providers to assist the board in administering the fund, including without limitation, legal counsel and actuary investment managers or certified public accountant, professional investment counselors or consultants, and a custodian. How am I supposed to monitor those individuals?
Well, you see them every board meeting when they arrive and you're here. You have conversations with your executive director on those. If you have questions or concerns with their performance, go to your executive director with them. It's significant enough, maybe you and the executive director, or you disagree with the executive director, you go to the board chair and tell them you have issues with your service providers. That's how you monitor your service providers. You don't have day-to-day relationships with your service providers. That can potentially interfere with the relationship between the service and provider and the staff, which are most essential to the operation of the fund.
Okay, and that makes sense. And I think a lot of it comes back to being on the board as long as I have. And in the past, it wasn't handled that way. So it was very much like if you needed to get some information, it was okay to talk to the vendor.
Yeah.
If that's the direction the board wants to go, I'm okay with going that way. I would say just the more you spell it out, the more I know what the playbook is and then how to correctly, carry on with this.
I will say from a fiduciary counsel perspective, there's only so much you can playbook, and the other comes to being a good trustee and prudent. And knowing that talking to a vendor when a search has been contemplated since April and having that communication that then eventually disrupts the search process, I can write all the rules I want. Hopefully a trustee that's been on the board for 9 years would have the sense to say that's not a good fiduciary move and maybe ought to handle it a different way.
And just to add to that, had you reached out to me, Jeremy, I would have advised you to not talk to Foster & Foster because we had an RFP out. I would have done that. And I failed to understand why that did not happen, and I found out from Brad Heinrichs in a public setting when we were having that exchange that you called him about this issue. What it also did, as far as going back to, and let me elaborate on that, disrupting the fund operations. I had emailed Brad, sent him multiple emails. In the past, Brad has always been responsive, always been prompt when I request things of him. I sent him questions, he would provide answers, I asked him for a call, he would respond back. I was sending him inquiries that we had received from the Pension Review Board, and I also sent him city's census data request for this go-around. I did not receive any response from him, and I thought he's probably dealing with a lot of stuff here right now with the situation down in Florida. I'm not going to bother him, and I did not follow up on my request because of that. I saw him at the board meeting, and I had no idea what was going on, why he was so upset, until I found out why he was so upset. And that was unfortunate. And we all know what happened. He resigned.
Yeah, he was upset because the comments that you made in
comments were made from both sides, and I don't want to get into that. And it was made in a public setting for everyone to see.
All right.
That's what that phone call caused.
I just have one last question. Why isn't our actuary here today?
He resigned.
He gave 30 days notice.
But he's resigned. And so when we get into number three, I've got some things I want to discuss about that too. So if you don't mind, we can move on. I've got some cleanup to do. I failed to mention at the beginning of the meeting that the mayor is out of town and not in attendance, but the other four board members are. So with that, let's move on to item number three, discuss and consider Foster and Foster's resignation.
Trustees, I've provided Brad's resignation letter as well as it's included in the packet.
I noticed here there's not a reason given for the resignation. Did he relay anything to you directly?
No.
Okay. So one of the things that I'm looking at here is, okay, yeah, he gave 30 days notice, but I'm not sure if I have trust in their process at this point because it's obvious to me they're upset. Not to say that they would intentionally do anything wrong. I just don't believe they would have the same motivation and vigor to make sure they did a good job for us, especially when it comes to the COLA analysis, which is so important. So one of my questions is, if we didn't go with Foster and Foster to complete that, what kind of delays will we have if we did have delays? And if we did have delays, would we be able to make that COLA retroactive so we make everybody whole?
So the retroactive piece is for Chuck, but we do have six firms that have responded to our RFP. The board has the option to, of course, interview those firms at the October 28th board meeting. So that's one option, and as part of that interview, as I think about it, of course, the board has those two options. Again, with the Foster and Foster's notice, that's one option, since they have provided a 30-day notice. The COLA analysis and the board's decision is due in November, if I recall the policy correctly. And so the board, as part of its interview process, can talk to those firms and ask them if they commit to get the analysis done for that November board meeting. So that's also an option.
So are we going to have any discussions/interviews next week?
Yes,
on these six?
That's my goal, yes.
Okay.
I was planning to, and you all can certainly decide how you want to do it. I'm not going to make any recommendations like I have stated. There are six responses that I have provided to you. We can provide the cost summary, the fee summary for all six firms, and maybe include the top four, the lowest bidders, as the top four, and bring those to the board for interview, or we can request all six. It's up to the board.
Personally, because there could be little difference between four and six, I just don't have all six.
Okay.
Chuck, are you prepared to address whether, if this got delayed and say we couldn't make a final decision until January or February, would we be able to make that COLA retroactive?
I'd have to look. You have a specific COLA policy in terms of how you develop that. I think the ultimate decision has to be, I believe, by the end of November. Is that right, Anu?
Right. That's my understanding.
And so, and the reason that, I mean, kind of the background behind that policy, the reason to have it done in November, you said at times it was done in December, and it caused a lot of administrative heartburn in terms of trying to get whatever was decided in December implemented for January. I'm not sure if a retroactive was ever had to be done or if that was necessary, and I'm not sure when your January payroll was. But obviously, that's the big issue in terms of it's more of an administrative issue in terms of timing than otherwise. And I don't know, I mean, if you hired somebody next month, whether you could still get a November, you know, kind of process in place anyway.
So from an administrative standpoint, we'll have to make sure that the retiree members who retire in December – are processed first before we grant any COLA in January, right? That's what we'll have to make sure happens so we don't make any errors that has happened in the past. And so we can try our best to expedite that. The challenge would be if there are a lot of members retiring in December.
No, it's just more of a I'm not sure which paycheck it hits first, the COLA,
the January
check, right? And it's if you miss one, there could we'd have to determine
we'll
from
have
a retroactive right.
And,
well, you'd have to determine exactly from a retroactive perspective how to make them whole and everything of that nature. But frankly, if you get it decided before that, you know, you can kind of look at your policy and see what needs to be done in considering the circumstances and address that appropriately.
Okay. So the other option is if we allow Foster and Foster to go forward. I've already expressed my opinion on that. I'd like to hear from the rest of the board members. Jeremy?
They've done a great job for us in years past. I don't have any issues with them continuing. And I honestly think you could ask Brad and Foster and Foster if they would help us through the COLA period, and I don't see why he would not.
John, how do you feel?
I share your concerns, Chief, but absent an easy solution from a different vendor, we may have no choice but to do what Jeremy's suggesting, so we're kind of in a hard spot. Mm-hmm. And that's an open question. I don't know what everybody's comfort level is.
Belinda?
I agree. The timing component of this is my concern. And I think at the very least I would be okay with them doing the COLA analysis. Maybe we could ask them to provide additional backup on the analysis provided. Generally, they just provide us a memo and figures just for a comfort level, but I think from a timing perspective, that's really my concern.
Okay. I'll go along with y'all. So do we need to take any action or proceed? No. Okay.
One question I do have on the resignation, and maybe it's more of an offline question, because I know that there's going to be questions with the city's annual audit in relation to the analysis, their actuarial report. Is there some carryover period, although they've given us 30-day notice, in which they would have to respond to questions regarding the information provided previously?
The city, the actuary, repeat the question, please.
So there's certain information that's derived from the actuarial report that's created from Foster and Foster as of December 31st, 2021, correct? That information is used as part of the city's annual audit. And if there's any sort of questions, kind of going back to a news discussion about the back and forth, is there any sort of contract provision within their contract that would require them to...
Like a survival-type provision,
exactly,
or something along those lines? That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'd have to look. It could be something you could request the Foster and Foster, and if there's some type of... I mean, I've seen that in these types of situations as well. I mean, I don't know what Foster and Foster wants to do, but it's like survival provisions where you could have some type of, hey, we may need you for this or that, and if that does come up, you can charge for services appropriate with that type of review. Yeah.
Sure. And I do believe, I'm sure, looking at their resignation letter, that Foster and Foster understands and would be a part of the transition as well, so they ought to be, I believe they'll be forthcoming in that regard.
And I think if also just the COLA policy, we were talking about that itself. It's very defined in terms of what the parameters are and what things are. Obviously, there's work to be done, but it's not a good COLA policy is in place, as mentioned in the resignation letter. That helps, I think, put any guardrails around concerns that folks might have.
Okay. Any other discussion on this item? Are we good to go for next week, given the material we went over today?
I will reach out to the six firms and request them to come to our October 28th board meeting and set up those interviews. So I'll focus on that for sure.
Okay. Very good. We've exhausted our agenda. Is there anything else that needs to be discussed? And we are adjourned.